You're listening to Red Eye on Co-op Radio at CFRO 102.7 FM.
Oh no, the invasion of Iraq had nothing to do with oil. Don't mention the oil, was the ironic refrain of a folk song written by Leon Rosselson. And oh no, there was no plan for an occupation of Iraq. The war makers told us they were on a crusade against terror and to free the people of Iraq. Nearly 6 years later, foreign oil companies are scheming to seize Iraqi oil, and the U.S. government desperately wants to make its occupation permanent. To examine these realities, I'm joined by Ava Yashevich in Manchester, England. She's a solidarity activist with the Iraqi Federation of Oil Unions. Good afternoon, Ava, and welcome to Vancouver Cooperative Radio.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Shell, Exxon, British Petroleum, and Total, four oil giants, have just signed contracts with the government of Iraq. What can you tell us about these contracts?
Well, actually, they haven't signed them yet. They're supposed to sign them officially on the 30th, but apparently this has now been delayed, according to Reuters. But these are technical service agreements, which on the face of it sound reasonable, given that TSAs are the kind of contracts that Iraqi unions and civil society have been demanding, rather than production sharing agreement contracts, which allow companies to book reserves, to effectively own reserves, and to determine the rate of extraction and depletion and production. Technical service contracts, on the other hand, treat the foreign oil company or the investing company as a service provider. So a company like Shell will provide a service for 2 years and then leave or have to negotiate a new contract, thereby not accessing reserves or having any kind of control over the oil. However, with these TSAs, they vary because they were written by the companies themselves, which is very unusual, because in any public procurement process, it is the government or the state that puts out the contract and asks for what it wants. It's absolutely unheard of for an oil company to write a contract and then pass it to the government. And the second thing is that Shell, BP, Exxon, Chevron, Total, these companies are not used to providing services, or this is not their core business. And particularly in a country like Iraq, which has the second largest oil reserves in the world, their core business is actually owning reserves. So this is another strange development. If it was just services that the Iraqi government needs, then it would be a company like, for instance, Schlumberger or Baker Hughes that would have these contracts.
And I had heard that there was another aspect of the draft contract that they would have first right of refusal when production sharing agreements were on the table.
Yes, that's highly likely to be within the technical service agreements, definitely extension clauses and right of first refusal on those fields and potentially others, but definitely on the fields that they're performing technical services for. These contracts have not been made public. Many groups in Iraq and we too are advising and demanding that this should be the case, but throughout the whole process there has been no democratic process, and it's highly improbable that any kind of democratic process can take place under military and economic occupation.
There's been long debate and process of conflict over a new oil law that the Iraqi government seemed to be trying to get passed through the National Assembly. Could you tell us what the main dimensions of that oil law are and where it's at in terms of the process of struggle over its passage?
Well, the oil law will determine the terms under which foreign companies or any companies invest in the Iraqi oil sector. And it was first demanded by the International Monetary Fund as part of Iraq's reconstruction program, or economic reconstruction program, as a way of paying off its debts, which are odious debts and were accrued by the Saddam Hussein regime, and the Iraqi people shouldn't have to pay off these debts. But it was first an IMF benchmark. It then moved to being a top Bush administration benchmark, and it still remains so. And it was first drafted in July 2006, and the deadline for its passage from the IMF was December 2006. So it's already overshot five deadlines, despite massive economic and political and diplomatic pressure. Cheney, when he was in Baghdad in March, spoke extensively with the cabinet about the oil law and passing the oil law. And last year, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki even feared that his government would be toppled if he didn't pass the oil law. But 2 years on, it's still not been debated in the parliament, although parliamentarians have seen it, but there's not been a vote on it because the Bush administration, the occupation administration, knows that there is no parliamentary majority for the oil law to pass. If it was put to a vote right now, it would fail because most of the parties are opposed to it. Now, the provisions of the law, the initial draft talked about production sharing agreements, but because this was so controversial and there had been so much campaigning within Iraq and opposition from oil experts and trade unions, this term was dropped and replaced by very uncommon within the oil industry and terms such as an exploration and development contract or production and development contract. But the law stipulates that these contracts will last for 30 years, and its provisions are deeply worrying in terms of Iraqi sovereignty, because should Iraq want to renegotiate any of these contracts, it would not be able to do this using its own domestic legal system. It would have to go to an international investors tribunal and battle it out there, whereby Iraq would be treated on the same footing. Iraq, a country of 26 million people, would be treated on the same footing as a company like Shell, which is accountable to its investors, to its shareholders. Furthermore, there is no provision within the law for parliamentary scrutiny of contracts, which is a big deal given that certain fields in the south of Iraq, like Waskorno or Majnoon, could alone each account for 10% of government revenue. And Iraq is dependent on the oil industry for 95% of government revenue. So to have contracts signed that could affect such a large bulk of the national budget without any kind of democratic scrutiny or parliamentary oversight is very problematic. But if I may add, one of the most dangerous provisions in the oil law is the establishment of a federal oil and gas council, which will have ultimate decision-making power over which deals are signed. And this will have approximately 15 members sitting on it that would be representative of the various political sectarian forces within Iraq. And the problem with decision-making powers being given to this council is that it is likely to reflect the highly sectarianized nature of the Iraqi political system, which was, of course, originally put in place by the occupation authorities along sectarian lines. So this could escalate tensions, given that also regions would be allowed to sign their own contracts as well and develop their own oil industries. You could see battles between regions over which contracts and which companies to sign with. And this economic power that would be given to these sectarian elites within the country would embolden and further enshrine the existing political power that these forces have, which many, many people in Iraq oppose, because the vast majority of the Iraqi people are not sectarian in their mindset and are looking for a united Iraq.
Now, the United States has also been working, again, very secretly, to try and complete a Status of Forces Agreement, which the acronym for which is SOFA, and they want to use this to gain legal cover for its occupation to continue far into the future. What, despite the fact that the documents have been tried to be kept secret, what do we know about SOFA?
What we know about SOFA so far is that the status agreement would allow for, I think, 50 well over 50 military bases, permanent bases, to remain in the country indefinitely. I think it was in Mikhlatsky's that the U.S. government has already applied for 58 long-term military bases. There are already 30 major military bases in Iraq at the moment. But the agreement would effectively allow for immunity for soldiers and private military security companies, i.e. mercenaries, against any kind of legal proceedings from the Iraqi government. And I mean, this is a huge blow to any kind of Iraqi sovereignty or Iraqi self-definition of what constitutes a threat to the country. But it's unlikely that this agreement could ever be passed through parliament in Iraq, or whether it would survive being put to the vote in Congress in the U.S. as well. But the fact that this is being put on the table by the American administration is deeply, deeply worrying.
Well, they're presently there, the UK military and the Americans, under cover of a United Nations resolution which mandated their presence. But that expires in December. So if they don't get some alternative legal cover, they're technically there without any mandate at all.
Yeah, that's true. And there are people within there are representatives within the Iraqi parliament who are definitely favoring writing to the UN and saying, right, you know, we have our security now, it's time for the forces to go. So, I mean, the ideal is, that, of course, that there is a full withdrawal. However, there are other provisions that are being proposed by the Bush administration. One of them, or a set of contracts, in fact, being put out to tender by the Department of Defense and State Department, are for advisors to work within Iraqi ministries and also protecting the Iraqi courts and involved in witness protection. But this role of American advisors within the corridors of power in Iraq whilst the country is still occupied is incredibly dubious and very disingenuous, and represents just yet another layer of deepening unjust and unfair influence and interference in Iraqi affairs.
After World War I, it was Britain that occupied and colonized Iraq and set up a puppet regime through which it controlled the economy and the country. Mm. Do the current foreign arrangements with oil and oil industry giants and the military bases that you've been talking about bear any resemblance to that earlier pattern of colonization?
Very much so. In 1925, when the British had installed the puppet monarch King Faisal, this was when the Seven Sisters, the major oil companies, formed the Iraqi Oil Company, which was based in London, and concession contracts were signed whilst Iraq was occupied, whilst there was a puppet regime that were to last for 75 years. And there were rebellions after rebellions, riots, insurrections throughout this period because of the fundamental military oppression of the occupation, but the lack of democracy and the lack of any kind of justice whilst this puppet elite protected by occupation forces ruled. Now, I think this could be multiplied in the case of Iraq, because there are so many sectarian elites that will be empowered militarily and economically by the occupation. And if this oil law passes and production sharing agreement contracts are signed and the oil companies move in, then they will be bringing with them their mercenary companies, which will exacerbate and aggravate the situation of violence. They will deepen the conflict. And we see this where BP and Shell have operated in Colombia, in Nigeria. When these companies or any kind of governmental force attempts to act against the wishes of any civil population, any kind of people, of course there's going to be resistance, and that contradiction is insurmountable between the interests of the major oil companies and the neoconservatives in America and Britain, who wish to continue the presence in Iraq and continue to force their market agenda on Iraq, and the wishes of the Iraqi people, which are for recovery and genuine reconciliation and sovereignty over their economic, political, cultural affairs and identity.
So maybe we should look forward to the fact that July is a 50-year anniversary, really, of the end of British colonial control over Iraq with the triumph of a nationalist revolution there. Maybe that anniversary will have some echo in the present situation.
I would think so. I would think so. Who knows what will happen? Maybe another revolt.
Well, thank you very much for joining us this morning, Ava. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Bye-bye. You too. Bye.
I've been speaking with Ava Yashevich in Manchester, England. She's a solidarity activist with the Iraqi Federation of Oil Unions. And if you'd like more information about that Iraqi Federation of Oil Unions, you can get it on the web at basraoilunion.org, or you can find a link on our website at coopradio.org/redeye.